Okay, welcome to the Falls Cast. This is a production of the Falls Free Press in beautiful Cuyahoga Falls, where it is like 90 degrees today, June 9th, 2020. And we are here with some of our favorite Falls casters. Among us, myself, Alex Hall, moderator and likely interjector. We have our youth liaison, who recently finished his freshman year of college at Kent State University, Patrick Catanese.
Hello.
We have the Falls Free Press photographer extraordinaire and chef of Indian cuisine, Stephen Mulay.
Hello.
We have the bald and the beautiful, Mike Searle, and his lovely wife, Suzanne Searle.
Hello.
Hello.
And we have our nerd culture expert and all-around librarian advocate, Bart Sullivan.
Hello.
All right, so the Falls Free Press is the parent company, so to speak, of the Falls Cast, and we about 2 years ago founded ourselves as a free press style newspaper. We shifted to an online format, and we have done some podcasts in the past. We've spoken with Keys to Serenity founder Brenda Cameron Ryan, Cuyahoga Falls School Board member Anthony Gomez, and Falls Downtown Partnership Coordinator Abby Paskey. We're going to be bringing interviews to you in each one of these podcasts, and today we're actually going to include an interview with Stephen's wife, Jennifer Mulay, who's a healthcare worker, and she's going to talk to us about her experiences working through the COVID-19 crisis at the end of this podcast, so watch out for that. Our goal here is to talk about noteworthy local news in Cuyahoga Falls specifically, although we'll likely sometimes go into the greater Akron area more generally. That's kind of our goal here. I want to start out today talking about what everybody's talking about, basically. I mean, there are two major things that we're talking about every day in this country right now, and both of them are affecting Cuyahoga Falls. The first thing that we want to bring up today is the Black Lives Matter protest. Last Sunday, we had a Black Lives Matter protest here in Cuyahoga Falls. About 1 o'clock, people met downtown outside the pavilion, marched to the corner of Broad Boulevard and Front Street, and stood with signs and, you know, yelled at cars and got a lot of encouraging honks from cars, a couple of antagonistic ones as well. And then the group marched after a while from there down to the other end of Front Street, up next to Ohio Brewing, past City Hall, and to Oakwood Boulevard, where they stood opposite the police station and knelt for 8 minutes and 46 seconds on one knee in honor of the killing of George Floyd, who in Minneapolis, Minnesota, died as a result of having police kneeling on his neck for that amount of time. And also Breonna Taylor, who died in Louisville, Kentucky. So the protest was opposite the police station on Oakwood Boulevard, and then went from Oakwood Boulevard back down Front Street to Falls River Square, where the protesters refreshed themselves with some water, and then eventually continued protesting until as late as 4 p.m. as far as we know. We were in attendance, some of us just as protesters, we also streamed a whole lot of the event. So you can go to fallsfreepress.com or our Facebook page, facebook.com/fallsfreepress. To see the videos that we took of everything that happened. And we also just today, early this morning, well, really last night, if we're being honest, posted a gallery of images that Stephen took while he was there. Patrick, I want to ask you about this first, largely because, the majority of the people who were in attendance, I should say that the protest was organized by Jillian Trace. She's an incoming senior at Cuyahoga Falls High School. She was the one who posted the event on Facebook and had people come out and support her. There was no actual, like, formal event on Facebook. It was just kind of a post that was shared, and then eventually people showed up there. I counted 150 people by the time it got to Oakwood Boulevard. So, Patrick, a lot of people thought that you were actually an organizer. And as somebody who is you know, young and concerned in the community, I wanted to get your take on what you thought of the event and about the movement and everything more generally.
I think that the protests kind of showed, like, I like to see in our local community, because it's one thing to go to an Akron protest or a Kent protest, but it's like, I grew up in Cuyahoga Falls, so to see, like, your hometown, like, your community come together and, like, fight against injustice was great to see. And it was great to see all the young people, too, getting involved.
What did you think of how the event went down, Patrick?
I think it went very well. I think with any protest, you're going to have people that are antagonists and are against the movement. So I think it's important to focus on like positives. Like there was when we were at the marathon, we eventually went to Broad and Second Street. And I don't know if it was the owner or a worker for the marathon, but they came out with like a big, like 24 case of water. Then they came out with ice and cups. So it was just kind of nice to see the community, like a business owner supporting our cause.
Yeah, and there were a lot of young people there, a lot of the people who commented on our Facebook page. And I should say, too, we live in a city, of course, that for a long time was known as Caucasian Falls, and we are a group of white people, and it was largely white people at the protest. But for somebody your age and for the youth of this community, what do you think was the reason that there were so many young people, and is there a different perspective that young people in the community have on this issue than people who have maybe been here for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years?
I think with young people, I think what I kind of thought of this too, is that my generation, we've lived through so much like war and hatred and just all this negative stuff. I mean, I wasn't old enough to remember 9/11, but we were born around that time. And then all the school shootings and just everything going on. I think it was kind of like a last straw. Like I think a lot of people my age and a lot of people I went to high school with are even like registering to vote and all that stuff. Like I think it's just a lot of anger and outrage, but I think they're putting it to good use and registering to vote. And I think our generation is going to be a big change in this country and in the community, of course.
That's true. There actually were people there registering folks to vote. So that's nice to see. Steven, you're a photographer. You've been shooting pictures in this city for, what, 30, 40 years?
I moved here in 1995, so.
What was your perspective on the protest? Because you're somebody who was looking at it through the lens of a camera for at least, I guess, about an hour or so that you were there, however long you were there. You got a few years on Patrick. So what's your perspective on how that all went?
It was surprisingly organized and upbeat. And the mood was positive, and it was a lot of young people, more than I would expect. But it was still a good splattering of old people like me and middle-aged people anyway. I didn't see any senior citizens. I didn't see anybody that was too much older than I was. I wish I would have been able to stay for the whole thing. I wish – that's what I regret for me personally. But, yeah, I think it was well-received. And overall – I was paying attention to how many honks we were getting, positive honks, you know, and people yelling woo out the windows of their cars. I think it was overwhelmingly positive. That was what I got. And I only saw a couple people being jerks and a few more than others, but it's to be expected. This is a polarizing, it shouldn't be polarizing, but it is.
Yeah. In this community in particular, I mean, we do have the kind of a smattering of generations in the city that have kind of a stronghold in the community. I don't know if you thought about this, Stephen, but like, you know, we were talking to Patrick, who just finished his freshman year of college. You have kids that are about Patrick's age. So as a parent, how do you, you know?
I was happy to see people that were young people coming out that were my kid's age. I think that his generation, their generation, give me a lot of hope. There are an activist group. Trying to change the world through any means necessary. And I think it is necessary now because they've been squished down by everything for so long. I mean, every generation seems like they have it slightly worse these days. And they're the newest generation of age. They're the future. I'm actually pretty positive. I think they're going to do good things from what I see.
Bart, you drove by the protest later in the afternoon. What was your perspective on it as somebody who just kind of passed by in a car?
For starting as early as it had that day, I had assumed around 11 o'clock that the protest was over because I only saw a few people out there. But about 2 hours later, I saw on the other end of Front Street that there were still a ton of people and still a lot of drivers by honking as they passed. So I was really happy to see that it was lasting as long as it was, even with dwindling numbers.
Yeah. And I was going to ask Mike and Suzanne, I know you guys were kind of like tuning in on social media, and I think we should just acknowledge kind of the response that we got on social media. Suzanne, I know you sort of hosted a watch party. I don't really know what that means on Facebook, except that you share a video as it's going. What is your perspective, Suzanne, on the response that we've gotten on social media, the good and the bad?
Well, I think the majority has been good, and it's heartwarming. Yeah. I mean, there's been a few that, you know, like to pick, but I think for the majority, there's been a lot of likes, a lot of loves, a lot of positive responses. To talk about what Stephen was talking about this younger generation, kind of taking the ball and running with it and making change and demanding change. It was very impressive. I mean, I watched a lot of it live, and Mike and I did drive by around 4-ish, I think. And, you know, we beeped and waved, and there were still a lot of people there, and it was really nice to see. I mean, I'm impressed with this generation. I have a lot of faith. I mean, a lot of bad stuff has happened, and I think that they may be the one who will make the change. It's almost like the 60s, right? I mean, when they were protesting the war. I mean, they're taking it and running with it.
Yeah, there have been a lot of comparisons to the hippies. I keep hearing that in the media. Mike, I don't know, maybe you or Suzanne can answer this. I'd mentioned, you know, Stephen has kids about Patrick's age, and you guys do too. In fact, one of your kids just graduated high school. What are you guys hearing from your kids? I mean, we know what young people think as young people, but as parents, what are you hearing from kids that are this age?
Well, majority of what I'm hearing and noticing is that they're actually getting more and more proud to stand up for a belief or a cause that they, you know, actually do believe in. And looking at our demographics of a city being 90% white, you know, seeing majority of white people, and that's a common effort of coworkers and other people saying, well, there's a lot of white people out here, you know, protesting and, you know, standing up for Black Lives Matters and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, to me, that's a good thing. You know, that's an indication that people are aware of this now. And it's not just, you know, oh, just black people, you know, being upset or whatnot. It's actually people are starting to notice. I mean, Goodell and the NFL realized, hey, maybe we should have realized this and taken it seriously when Kaepernick was kneeling. We made a mistake. You know, now people are starting to take this seriously. And even driving through my way home, seeing Hudson and Stowe and other cities doing this, all young kids, you know, or younger. I mean, there's a fair amount of older people out there, but it's all younger kids, you know, Patrick's age, you know, our kids' age, you know, graduating, all these kids that want change. They want to take an active role in doing something and changing what's been here. And it's starting to happen. You know, everyone's buzzing about it. And even our kids, they're talking about it all the time.
Yeah. At the dinner table, it's a big conversation that we have. We talk about it to try to see where their head is and what they're thinking. And, you know, it's pretty nice to see them taking an active role and wanting to make a change.
Yeah. Well, I should say, I was driving around today, Tuesday, we're recording this on Tuesday the 9th, in Talmadge, on Talmadge Circle. There were protesters on the circle, inside the circle, so that as people drove through, you could see their signs, and it looked like there was a news crew there too. I mean, there were some big, you know, fancy looking cameras and tripods and stuff. So, it's not over. I mean, it's obviously not over in the country, and nor is racism or police brutality, which is what this is all about. But, next Sunday, now the 14th, there is a new event. It says community leaders gather to honor George Floyd and the movement for Black Lives. It's going to be at the Riverfront Pavilion here in the Falls. At 7:30 p.m., they're going to have a candlelight vigil, and it's going to end with that. Some of the speakers at 8 p.m. include Mayor Don Walters, I think it's the First Christian Church, Pastor Debbie Sachs, also a well-known local activist, Sonny Matthews, is going to be out there speaking as well. They're going to do a candlelight, and they're going to do 8 minutes and 46 seconds of silence. And there's going to be a protest, I understand, during the day downtown before this event even gets started, that is very likely to lead into the event. I'm glad to see that. I sort of wondered during the protest if we were going to see the mayor come out. And I should say too, I mean, the police were at the protest. Mostly what they were doing was they were helping, guide the procession. So like when we were downtown, they would, as we started to march down Front Street and toward City Hall, they actually, even though there was a green light at Portage Trail and Front Street, they stopped traffic so that the parade could kind of go through. And then that happened going across Second Street. And then when they were up on Oakwood Boulevard, right across from the police station, the police drove by. And the guy, I don't know which officer it was, but he was inside the car, smiling, waving. While some of the protesters were walking down Front Street, they did actually, you know, get on their intercom from the car and say, you know, please get on the sidewalk. Which was, you know, I think appropriate. People should be on the sidewalk. But at the same time, there's a lot of animosity and a lot of confusion and stuff with the police right now. And I think some of that is just because of what's happening, you know, what the movement's about in the first place. So. So the next couple things I wanted to discuss really had to do with COVID-19, which is the other major thing that's happening in our community right now and in our country. So we have these two like massive things happening, not just in our city, in our county, in our state, but in our country. And that's, you know, that's COVID-19. I saw this on the internet and in the weekly paper here in the Falls, that there were a couple of hot spots that were in Cuyahoga Falls. One was a place called Alcide, something like that. Probably Alcide. They manufacture vinyl siding and windows and doors and stuff like that. They're headquartered on State Road, and they do have a manufacturing facility there. They were on this list of businesses where there were people who were infected with the disease, with the coronavirus. And so the employees or people who were, you know, going to be in contact with those employees were being encouraged to go and get tested. So it was sort of like a hot spot. And then the same thing with this company, Spunfab. They make adhesive fabrics. If you can imagine like acoustic paneling, like that foam stuff that they use in recording studios, they're the ones that manufacture the sort of like sheets of adhesive that might be used to put those up. And they just a lot of different kind of like polymer adhesives. They are in the industrial business park back there off State Road across from the post office. And so they were another one where it was a hot spot, because, and so as a result of that, they wanted to have people get tested if they were either, you know, working there or coming into contact with employees. Did you see that article? What did you think of
it? I saw that article. Yeah. And none of it's surprising. It maybe they have something that they're doing that people are not being able to observe the 6-foot rule. You know, that's the only thing I can think of. You know, if somebody's sick and then they just transfer, it's whatever you touch your face, touch something else, it's going to happen. Any kind of large manufacturing facility, that's not like a hospital that's constantly being cleaned, you're going to have those kind of problems. And so none of that's a surprise. I'm surprised there wasn't more of it, actually. And more places.
Yeah, so I mean, this really can lead into a discussion just about the reopenings that we're seeing in general. I don't know about you guys, but I've been driving down Front Street and seeing in the evenings, Leo's will be very busy. I was in Five Guys down on Howe Avenue, and you know, they have tables set up. There were people eating inside. There was a man eating with a girl about the age of one of my little girls. She didn't have a mask. He did. You know, it's, I don't know. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but it just feels a little scary to me. Like I don't want to come off as though I am scared, but it does. It's just like the jokes that you hear people making online about like, oh, I'm watching a movie and there's all these people in a room together and it's like, they're not social distancing, you know? What do you guys think about all the reopenings and do you think it's time? Do you think it's not time? What are your thoughts on this? Go ahead, Stephen.
Jennifer and I have gone out a couple times to eat. One was to Brentwood. We sat on the patio. It was the middle of the week. It was like a Tuesday or a Thursday or something, and for lunch. So it normally that would not be a busy time. And there was actually quite a bit of people in there, more than I would expect. But there are less tables. All the employees were wearing masks. With the exception of the owner, sometimes you pull it down to talk, which was annoying. But our server, you know, mask, and they, you know, they claim everything's washed and clean between tables. I mean, I didn't witness it, but I'm assuming that they are. But yeah, there's an exit and an entrance. You got to walk in a certain way, and then you have to walk out a different exit than the entrance. So they have to. Yeah, it was nice, but I was definitely nervous, and I was definitely not okay with it, but it is what it is. I mean, you can't stop living.
Mike and Suzanne, you guys have, I mean, kids that you got to buy groceries for. And Mike, I know you've been doing yard work, which means you must have had to go to a home store to buy supplies and stuff. What are your guys' thoughts on all the reopenings and stuff?
My thoughts, as far as restaurants and whatnot, personally, I'm still kind of wary about going back to them. I mean, I'd rather do takeout and eat at home versus sitting out, even if it's a patio. I'm just paranoid like that. Doing all the home improvement stuff, going to Menards, I frequent there more just because they require you to wear a mask. I haven't really gone to Lowe's or Home Depot much. I mean, through work, I've gone to Home Depot, and half people are wearing masks, the other half aren't. All the employees are, but half of them are incorrectly wearing it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's just kind of tugged out of the way to the side. And I'm like, I understand if you're in a warehouse and you're away from people, sure. But you never know who's going to come around a corner or whatnot. So just wear the damn thing. But personally, that's my choice, is to shop at Menards because I know everyone's got one. You know, and occasionally you'll run into somebody who pulls it down, or you're outside in the landscaping area and whatnot, and they may have it pulled down or whatnot, but somebody will kind of give them the little side eye and they put it back on, you know. But for my own peace of mind, that I'd rather go to Menards because of that.
Yeah.
I have been working delivering food, so I've been in a lot of restaurants, and I've seen the way a lot of different places are handling all of this as far as reopenings and stuff. And so, you know, sometimes it's weird. I will say the basement in Cuyahoga Falls, which was immediately popular as soon as it opened, they started constructing a new patio. And the next thing we knew, it was the coronavirus. I was there not too long ago. Their patio was pretty full. It was a nice day. When I went inside, there were people. It's a dark bar on the inside. There were people sitting around the bar, nonchalantly eating food at the bar. And that was the weirdest for me in that moment, in that dark, sort of small. It's not small, but it feels small because of how dark it is. That was a little bit too much for me. But, you know, my kids love to go out to eat. We do get a lot of takeout and stuff. So we're anticipating very much being able to go back out to eat. Steven, I know you went to Hi-Ho.
Yeah, we went to Hi-Ho this past weekend to have a couple beers and also to buy some crowlers. And it was our first visit inside since they opened officially. And for the most part, people follow the rules. Patrons are supposed to wear masks inside, but they're not really enforcing it. So there's a lot of people that didn't have masks. They came in that should have had masks, and they did, and they just didn't say anything. But all the employees definitely had a mask, and they had, you know, tape on the floor where you can wait 6 feet back from the counter, because that's where you have to go to order your food. There's no waiters or waitresses or server, so you have to get all your food and order your beer at the bar at two different locations. And they took away some chairs at the bar, and they took out a lot of tables, and they doubled the size of their patio. And they also put a giant plexiglass window up in front of their wood-fired pizza oven to prevent, which I guess, COVID from coming out of the employees that were in there. But also, to me, it looks like they're burning in a hot hell oven. It just holds all the heat in.
Yeah, and I imagine that plexiglass getting warped over time too.
Yeah, I looked at it and I was like, man, those poor SOBs are just burning up in there. But yeah, they did well. And actually, the owner's wife, who's very pregnant, was actually serving beer. She was there.
I would say that, like, it seems to me that the restaurants are doing the best they can. I don't want to denigrate any business that's choosing to open because they've lost business and they need to recoup those losses as best they can.
The patrons are the problem. You know, they are, because you can't turn them away. You turn them away, you're going to get a bad reputation and people are going to get mad. They're going to try to boycott you. I get it. It's they got to make a living.
Yeah.
But yeah, almost nobody was wearing a mask.
Yeah.
Even outside or inside. They just weren't paying attention. They weren't even paying attention to the 6-foot rule. So people's attitudes aren't where they should be.
Yeah.
And nobody's taking it seriously. Oh, it's over. Everybody thinks it's over. They're acting like it's over.
Yeah. So it's not just restaurants, obviously. Walmart, you walk in, they have one person who's counting people as they walk in. They have somebody who is standing there just cleaning carts and handing them to people. You go into any store, there's actually like directions of traffic that you're supposed to go, which only about half the people follow, which is very frustrating. The Natatorium is reopened. They have limited hours. You can't use all the equipment. They've had to move things around. During the peak of the sort of shutdown, they had people doing fitness classes and stuff on the Natatorium's Facebook page. So they do like a Facebook Live of like a step class or whatever. And then also there are other park facilities that have open, like golf courses. The golf course is open now, but they've lengthened the amount of time between tee off. You can only get one cart per person unless you're from the same household. So there are a lot of different rules in a lot of different kinds of places. Coronavirus is something it's still here. We're dealing with it, and I was just curious to get everybody's perspective on that. I don't know if you guys saw the article about the 28-year-old former Cuyahoga Falls police officer who was released from prison. The article I read was not really clear about whether that was specifically because of COVID-19. He served 7 months of a 2-year sentence after, being sentenced for sexual abuse, I think.
Yeah. I think it's ridiculous. I mean, it was, I don't think it was, a, I think it was sexual assault. Reading about it, I believe that it was originally a rape charge. Yeah. And they took it down to, I think, sexual assault. And yeah, he gets, well, I think it was 2 years was the sentence he got, and then he got out after 7 months.
He has to register as a tier 3 sex offender and serve 5 years probation in addition to the 7 months he served.
Well, you know, I don't know. I just feel like as a woman, I don't think that it was enough. I mean,
especially when it should have been 5 years.
I mean, I was reading a little bit about it because I was kind of curious on what the story was. I don't remember hearing about it. And from what I gathered, they met at a bar, and I don't know, what transpired, but they were back at her place, and I think there was another person there with them, and she woke up, so she must have been sleeping, and he was in the process of raping her.
My God.
So I don't know exactly what happened. I mean, he was obviously found guilty, and I believe he did admit that he did it. They were talking about how hard it would be for a ex-cop to be in jail. So I'm not sure if we're supposed to feel sympathy for that or not. But
crime's a crime, whether you're a cop or not.
Right. I mean, that kind of goes right back to the whole Black Lives Matter, right? I mean, yeah. Are cops, going to be held to the same rules and laws that we all have to abide by? And I don't know. It kind of irritated me, and I would like to know more about why he was released, if it was about COVID or not. I don't know. I just would also say that the story that I was reading, they were talking about how great of a guy he was in the past, that this is something that he's never done before and how wonderful he is. And I'm just kind of tired of hearing that storyline.
Like Brock Turner.
Yeah, exactly. Just like Brock Turner. And, I don't know. I mean, how many times do we allow a guy to get away with, sexually assaulting or raping a woman that we don't call them a good guy anymore? I mean, they don't think of it as ruining a female's life. And we could get into a really long discussion about, gender and gender equality. But
and to get to me is he was probably originally charged with rape, but he took a plea deal to get down to sexual assault. That's to me what it sounds like. He either had a good lawyer or he admitted doing it as a plea deal. But that's just me throwing that out there.
There's going to be another school levy on the ballot this year, just shifting gears. This is a 7.9 mil renewal. So it's a levy that's been on the books, and we've been paying property taxes toward this already. It collects $5.7 million a year just for expenses. And there are a lot of little levies like this. There's going to be another one, I think, in 2021, maybe two in 2021, that are, again, renewals. So these are not new like the one that was just passed. Do you think Cuyahoga Falls is ready for another levy and that everybody's going to be cool and pass this one? Who wants to go first and talk about how ready we are for this next levy?
Well, I think the answer is no. I'm not saying that it's not needed, but are we ready? No. I mean, coming out of the COVID-19 and a lot of people have been without jobs, and the levy that was passed for the new school building barely passed. And I think that it's going to be a hard sell. I mean, I think that, I mean, obviously I'm going to I shouldn't say how I would vote, but I'm going to vote for it. I normally do vote for support for schools because I believe that we should.
Strong schools make a strong.
Strong school, yeah. It's going to be a really hard sale. I mean, the people don't have the money. I mean, a lot of people are struggling. They're worried about, you know, how they're going to put food on the table. And even if this is not going to take more money out of their pocket, they're not going to see it that way. They're going to see the school coming and trying to take more money and not knowing where it's going. It's going to be hard to get them to understand what this is.
Yeah, there's still a lot of pent up animosity about the last levy. A lot of people were upset that it passed. And I think that they're going to want to punish, even though they know it's a renewal levy. Most people do. And so it's actually no new taxes. They're just continuing on with what was already there. They're still going to, I think they're going to try to make the school system pay. There's a lot more mad about that. Rightfully so or not, whatever. I voted for it, and I think it was a good idea. The schools were old and crappy, but that's not the point we're talking about here. So, you know, that's already happened. I think it would be a disaster for it not to pass. But will it pass? I don't know. The only thing that maybe you can think about is maybe since the progressive base of this city and is going to come out in force to, because they're sick and tired of you know who, as president, they're going to come out in force, and they're going to force a lot of down ballot things to pass that normally might not pass. I think that could play in too. So you have both factors working against each other. We'll see.
Yeah, it seems to me the big issue is just that it's going to be contentious precisely because the big school levy, last year, it passed really narrowly. But the people who were on the levy committee worked really hard to get it to pass. And although there was a lot of opponents, like on social media and stuff, there really wasn't a campaign to oppose the levy, you know, on the ground in terms of signs and all those kinds of things.
Yeah, I'm looking at it as it's twofold right now, where one, as Suzanne just said, because of COVID, a lot of people are at, you know, a loss for money. But because of COVID also, I can see many people seeing, half a semester, I had to teach my own kids. You know, the teachers didn't teach my kids. I taught my kids. So why should I be paying more for the teachers? But at the same time, they taught their kids and they saw how much of a pain in the butt it was.
That's a good point.
So
give them all raises.
Either way.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Mike, did you have something to add?
I was going to reiterate kind of what Stephen was, or go along with that point. I mean, I think there's a lot of people that were upset that the levy passed. Yeah. A lot of people felt it wasn't needed. It was bloated. They, quote, lied to us from the beginning because it was X number of dollars, 90-some million, ended up being 112 or 120. I forget the exact numbers. But then, you know, the people, I think the people's argument when this or these two come up is, why didn't they plan for this accordingly in the other levy? You know, we wouldn't have to worry about these two. You know, why we just passed a levy? Why do I need to pass another one? Even though it's a renewal, they're not going to see it that way.
Yeah. Stephen, last word on the school levy.
My concern is that the cuts coming from the state because of the COVID and unemployment situation, trying to balance the budget, I think it's going to hammer us bad.
Yeah, I mean, the levy that did just pass, the state is required to kick in the money that they said they would kick in. So we're still going to get the $67 million that they were going to kick in as a result of us passing our levy. And part of that is the operating budget, which in other school districts, the problem sort of was that they built a new school and then they couldn't afford to run it. But these other levies that we have are also, I think, operating expenses largely, and they pay into different things. So, you know, having a new school and an operating budget to run that school is great, but if you don't have other pools of money that you need to do other things, then that could prove difficult. So one thing I think is really interesting about this is it was in the paper over the weekend. This is Tuesday. I have not seen anything from anyone about this levy. You know, so yeah, there's an emoji for that, right? it's the cautiously optimistic, slightly worried emoji. You know,
yes,
it's the face Suzanne was just making, which our listeners can't hear because this is a podcast. But in any case, I do think that's interesting, and I'm curious to see what's going to happen over the next week. Maybe COVID-19 and Black Lives Matter protests are just going to totally overshadow it, and then we're going to get to November, and it's going to be, you know, a week before the election is when people are going to go crazy. But I do know that the levy committee, which just passed the big levy that we saw in November, is already, you know, working to you know, regroup and try and get this one passed too. So. This last point, I know this probably seems insignificant, but I want to ask Bart specifically about this one because listen, we all know Bart's dad pretty well, and I have heard him go on about the garbage cans next to Metropolis popcorn. Bart, do you know about his attitude about this, and do you want to talk about it?
I don't know what his attitude towards it is, but it's probably very similar to mine. Every time I drive down Porter's Trail, it just looks horrible. It could, that area being right there along the main street could be so much more than just hideous garbage cans sitting out front. Like there used to be that bus stop used to be really nice. There used to be giant signs promoting things alongside that building, and now it's just an eyesore.
Now it's just garbage cans. Yeah, I included this because I think it's kind of funny, but in part because I salute the city that they're taking care of it. It doesn't seem like it's a huge expense to them. They've sort of like rolled it into this legislation that's going to also allow them to upgrade and fix up the parking lot that's right there behind Flurry's, which I drove by today. There's a big dumpster sitting in there. It's very narrow. I've had to drive in there with a car before. I thought it was interesting. I mean, this was on the front page of the paper too, I think, right?
Pressing news.
Yeah, it's very important. I mean, you know, as for a local podcast, it's something I think we should discuss. But I know that the community, including Bart's dad, is going to be happy that there's going to be a new enclosure for a dumpster that's going to eliminate those garbage cans and make it nicer downtown. We have this beautiful downtown, and we have a whole bunch of garbage cans right under a beautiful mural of Metropolis Popcorn. So I think that it's great that they're going to do that. And, you know, I don't know how much there is to say about it. It seems like we're all in favor.
Yes. Although I must admit that never paid attention to it because I don't go down Porter's Trail a lot. So,
well, and I think it does speak to sort of the bigger point, which is that the administration, I think, in my opinion at least, but I think we probably all agree that the mayor's administration is doing a really good job of improving the city. Something as big as creating a beautiful new downtown space and as small as creating a dumpster enclosure to make sure that that space is universally beautiful. Mike, final word on this one?
Oh, I was just going to say how Bart was channeling his inner dad there. And but I do agree. It's kind of nice to, I mean, to me, it didn't bother me as much as Bart and Tom, but it is kind of nice to see them trying to do something to make it look acceptable. You know, I mean, everyone needs trash cans, but no one really wants to see them.
Something you don't want to think about, but it needs to be done. So,
all right, guys. Well, that's our first dry run, test run episode of the Falls Cast. Thank you to all of you guys. And after this, we're going to have an interview with Jennifer Mule. So I'll see you guys all later.
Bye.
Really quickly, we need to clarify that Jennifer Mule is not speaking on behalf of Cleveland Clinic in the following interview, and that the opinions and views expressed are her own.
Okay, so we're here with Jennifer Mule. Jennifer, you work in the health field, and I wanted to talk to you because I know that COVID-19 is obviously still at the forefront of everybody's imagination right now, and you're somebody who is dealing with it kind of firsthand. Can you tell us what it is you do?
I work at the Cleveland Clinic. I work in clinical research. That means that I run clinical trials, and my trials are focused on patients with Parkinson's disease. So usually Parkinson's disease strikes the elderly, and as you know, currently with the COVID-19 pandemic, the elderly are at a higher risk of contracting the disease and having a more significant and at times fatal outcome.
Cool. Yeah, thanks for that. You actually go to an office and work with patients?
Right. I do see patients. I go into the office when I have a patient. When I don't, we are working remotely. But, you know, patients need care, so we are required to be there. Everyone at the clinic is required to wear a mask. The patients are requested to wear a mask. It's probably not a strict requirement. That could change if we see spikes in COVID numbers. Currently, we've been getting daily updates on the number of patients that we have in the hospital. It's been pretty steady. It's not as high as it was back in May. So that's good. But, you know, we're going to keep following it for the next few weeks. But we take a lot of safety precautions. The rooms have been, there's a lot of sanitizing going on all day long. The medical assistants are in and out in between patients. We've taken away a lot of our waiting room chairs, and we have limited the visitors that are allowed to come to the hospital. So patients weren't allowed to have visitors unless they were maybe pediatric, under 18, or had special needs, dementia, or were incapable of ambulating, walking around on their own. But that's starting to change. We're in a phase two of startup. You know, maybe one visitor is allowed to accompany a patient now, but everything is done trying to limit the amount of bodies that are in one place at a time. So it's really, our business is slow. We're still not seeing as many patients coming in. A lot of them want virtual visits. The institute that I work in, the Neurological Institute, had a huge conversion of inpatient visits turn into remote visits. All the doctors had to learn how to use different platforms and technologies. The Cleveland Clinic had started out with one platform. It was just failing, crashing, freezing. They dumped it. They got a new platform in, set it up very rapidly. Our IT support and help team set up like tens of thousands of Cleveland Clinic employees for remote homework. So it was a really huge, massive undertaking. And I do know that the Cleveland Clinic was very efficient and very effective. And we have been lauded even by the White House. Our president, Dr. Tom Mihaljevic, did speak a little bit about the Cleveland Clinic at a White House press conference maybe a month ago, and, you know, talked to us about some of the things that the Cleveland Clinic has implemented to deal with the pandemic because of our success. So I feel grateful to work at the clinic, but it was very stressful when it first started. Half my department lost the access to the building that they see patients in because it got turned into the COVID testing center. So everyone just got kicked right out of that building and had to kind of get reassimilated throughout the clinic. And we're still feeling the ramifications of that. We've lost capability of seeing as many patients in hospital, but that's also kind of worked out a little bit okay because now a lot of patients want to be seen remotely. So we would like to start bringing more patients back. I was seeing some numbers that significant numbers of patients are not being seen for cancer diagnoses, routine healthcare where you could catch, you know, risk factors for heart disease. So we don't want to see a boom of other diseases and morbidities that aren't even related to COVID, but because patients are too scared to come, those diseases are going to, you know, kind of raise their ugly heads and not get the treatment that they need. So the COVID has really affected a lot of folks, not just for patients that contract it, but just your normal everyday average Joe who needs a physical and, you know, maybe they're going to catch that high cholesterol that needs some treatment.
Yeah. Wow. That's a lot. Because of the nature of the ways in which you guys' patients have been receiving treatment, then you guys haven't seen cases yourself. I mean, do you know of patients that have had the disease?
None of my clinical trial patients have had the disease. The study sponsors have rolled out some guidances on, you know, if a patient does get COVID, can they still be in the study? And so we've been working with that. And, you know, I collect blood samples and spinal fluid samples from these patients. And that all of a sudden became, oh, my gosh, if those samples are contaminated, you know, you don't have the precautions in place to protect you from, you know, any kind of aerosolization while you're centrifuging or spinning or aliquoting these samples. So a whole policy had to get rolled into place. We weren't allowed to collect the blood samples until we had, you know, the safety PPE and new techniques down. But none of my patients have had COVID. I'll see there's a little special green button in on the appointment list when you see patients who've had a negative test or a positive test. So the clinic is tracking it very carefully, and they have a huge, robust amount of COVID-19 clinical research going on. And those studies are taking precedence over any other study at the clinic to try and gather as much data as they can about with all the patients that are coming in that have COVID. They're trying to collect every drop of data that they can about these folks to, you know, try and develop better treatments, figure out really what's going on with this disease, how many body systems it does affect, things like that. I do know that I heard about, we were sent a letter from a patient who had come in for a treatment in a different center who had a COVID diagnosis, and then she had to get quarantined, and she sent us a letter that the clinic broadcast with her permission about the kind of care she got at the clinic and the follow-up, and, you know, how scared she was, and, you know, having COVID on top of her other disease, and but that she was really well taken care of and followed every day by clinic healthcare professionals, and, you know, she didn't have a bad outcome. So that was... it was nice to see that letter, but it was also like, wow, she's in the same building as I am. And, you know, it was just a little scary.
Yeah. And so what is your perspective then on the way that this has been handled by Ohio Governor Mike DeWine?
I think he's done the best job that he possibly could with the information that he was getting. I never disagreed with any of his actions until we started getting close to opening back up. And I kind of feel like he might have caved in a little bit to the pressures that be, all those crazy protesters who were, you know, wanting their haircuts and stuff. So, you know, maybe that put the squeeze on him to open up a little sooner. But, you know, we can't stay shut down forever, and the numbers are stable, and the amount of people in the hospital has gone down, and we're learning more about it. So I'm pretty supportive of DeWine's actions. I think he's done an excellent job so far, and I just hope that he continues to proceed with caution.
Yeah, and just obviously our podcast is about Cuyahoga Falls. So what's your thinking on, you know, the ways in which Cuyahoga Falls has begun to reopen? And not only just that, but also the kind of perhaps cavalier attitudes, you know, that some people have about the disease and the reopening and all that.
Yeah, you know, I've been on the Facebook pages, and I've been out and about, you know, so to some stores, and you kind of see a different reaction to with people than at some stores than others. I think that the folks in the Falls, it almost seems like 50-50. Half the people I see out and about don't have masks on, seem quite unconcerned, don't, you know, are kind of in large crowds and big groups. And then the other half are just a single shopper with a mask, seeming to do their business very quickly, and kind of obeying the 6-foot social distancing, you know, suggestions. So I wish that more people in our town would take it a little more seriously. You know, it's not a hoax, and it's a dangerous disease, and it's new. We don't know enough about it. So why take a gamble when you can just stay a little farther away from people, wear a cloth mask, and, you know, not be so cavalier about it.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us and talking to us about this, your unique perspective as somebody working in healthcare. We hope that you and Steven stay safe, obviously.
Thanks. My pleasure. I appreciate talking to you.
FallsCast is a production of the Falls Free Press in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio. Today's episode featured Alex Hall, Patrick Catanese, Bart Sullivan, Stephen Mulay, Mike Searle, and Suzanne Searle, plus a special interview with Jennifer Mulay. Please check out the Falls Free Press at fallsfreepress.com or on social media at facebook.com/fallsfreepress or @falls_free on Twitter or Instagram. We thank you for listening to this episode, which was recorded and edited by Alex Hall. Please subscribe to our podcast and tell your Cuyahoga Falls friends and family so that they can listen as well.